New Zealand is falling behind other Western countries in closing the gap between men and women's wages. But according to researchers, we have the opportunity to become a world leader. The average gender pay gap here is 9%, though it's 25% if you account for the difference in pay between a Pacifica woman and a Pākehā man. Australia, the UK, France, Spain, Sweden and South Africa have all introduced compulsory reporting. New Zealand has not. A new report analysing the gender pay gap reporting in these six countries, prepared for the United Nations by the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College London, shows there's a growing appetite for change and transparency in many countries. That organisations think it's important to publicly report their pay gap and that they can profit from it. Minnie Cooper-Coles is a research fellow and the author. Kia ora, Minna.
Hello, good morning.
Lovely to talk to you. Mind the Gap, New Zealand co-founder Delwyn Stewart, wants the gender pay gap reporting to happen here, including Māori and Pacifica pay gaps, and for it to be mandatory. Morena Delwyn.
Morena.
And she says if New Zealand accomplishes ethnic pay gap reporting, it could be ahead in world rankings. Also with us, the former Westpac chief executive, now Kiwi Rail chair, David McLean. During David's time at Westpac, the company reported a gender pay gap where men were revealed to be paid an average 31% more than women. So what are business leaders doing? Good morning, David.
Morena, Catherine.
Good morning, everyone. Well, Minna, let's start with you. What does your report indicate, please, about the international trends?
Well, we've seen that worldwide the move has towards mandatory gender pay gap reporting is really taking off. Just this year, we've had Ireland as well introduce mandatory pay gap reporting, and a lot of countries across Europe. South Africa has one interlinked with their racial pay gap reporting system. So it's something that's happening worldwide, and appetite is growing for it.
What did you learn, or what were some of the key standouts from the analysis done on the six countries that do report?
So we found that on these six, we looked at these six countries, that they're only a fraction of the ones which actually have mandatory pay gap reporting, but we found that there are certain elements that make for really good pay gap reporting, and when they're lacking, it can be not so effective. So we looked at things like having accountability mechanisms, making sure there's transparency built into the process, and we thought something that we'd love to see introduced more worldwide was an element of intersectionality, so ethnicity becoming something that can be reported on, because many countries, like in the UK, we have the pay gap is different across different ethnicities as well. And I think that's something where New Zealand has its opportunity to be very world leading and introduce exciting new legislation if you do go down that route.
So where you hear that in this country there's a gender pay gap of 9% on average, but 25% when you include different ethnicities, that's exactly what you're saying is an opportunity for us to build in and actually show others.
Exactly. I think the ethnicity element is really important in most countries where there's inequality. Having an ethnicity, an intersectional look at it, so not just gender, but also ethnicity and any other like categories, is quite useful if you can introduce that from the beginning. Because the gender pay gap does tend to be much greater in certain groups. And I think that the point of gender pay gap reporting, mandatory gender pay gap reporting, is to highlight where inequalities exist and help companies to address them. And having this double focus can actually really help to target and understand what's really creating those gender pay gaps.
Is the evidence that mandatory reporting does close the pay gap?
Well, as I said, we looked at only six of the many countries which do it. And yes, it does seem to help. But we found that we've had a quite difficult few years with it. Of course, it's been COVID, et cetera, which has been awful for women and forced many women out of the workplace or to take lower paid roles as they had to balance it with childcare, et cetera. So we haven't had the best sort of sample few years, if that makes sense. But there is evidence that when you look at the companies which are having to are being obliged to report compared to ones which are perhaps just below the threshold. For example, in the UK, it's only companies with over 250 employees. But if you look at those ranging around that number, we found that a report by someone called Jack Blundell at LSE found that there was the gender pay gap was reduced in those companies which are reporting.
It was pretty modest, though, wasn't it? It was pretty modest.
That was only 1.6% they found there, but other research has found that women are employed are more likely to be employed in a higher employment. So that's 5% more likely. But if you're talking about gender pay gaps of 9%, then 1.6% is quite substantial. But as we said, it's been a difficult few years for it with COVID, etc. But also we have the problem that some of these systems that are already in place aren't as thorough as we would have liked to have seen them. For example, the UK, they have a transparency mechanism, but they don't require companies to set out action plans as to how they're going to try and tackle their pay gap.
So is there consistency first in how it's reported? And then second, what is the difference? What makes a more quality scheme? You've alluded to one thing. Is there accountability afterwards? But first, is there clear consistency in the way things are reported?
Absolutely not. So that's one of the things we really would love to look at. Different countries have completely different priorities. There's a kind of a general formula for the actual gender pay gap. But big multinational companies find it quite difficult where there are different criteria in different jurisdictions. So that there isn't like a global recognized criteria for what needs to be published, and that's something that I think would be great to work on. But the different countries have different requirements. I think a really good one would have some kind of up and down accountability, so up to a government agency who's checking on it, or at least publishing it, reporting it, but also something where a mechanism where companies are obliged to talk to employees or employees' representatives when they're publishing their gender pay gap reporting in order to try and work out solutions and put in place some kind of action plans. So not just leaving it at reporting, but trying to see what tasks they can put in place to try and address that gender pay gap.
Did voluntary reporting work?
Short answer is no. So what we found when there was voluntary reporting was it was the companies that were doing quite well already ended up reporting in the UK. We had that for a couple of years. And then because there was a lack of progress, they introduced mandatory reporting. And mandatory reporting is important because you start getting that comparison across sectors and across rivals. And you also bring in all the companies which aren't thinking about their gender pay gap. And it is, for many of them, we spoke to a number of employers for our report, and they said that it was a kind of just shining a spotlight on an area which they hadn't perhaps thought about quite so much. So it wasn't, it's not obliging them to do anything about it, but it was drawing attention to a whole new area and bringing media and external pressure to bear on that.
What did the businesses say they believe to be the pros and cons? Again, you're probably talking to the ones who are engaged in the first place, but what did they say were the pros and cons of doing this?
So I think that the consistent con is purely a matter of like this administrative work going into it. But many of the employees we spoke to said the first year it took a bit of adjusting and working out and, you know, what's included, what's not included. And then once they kind of worked that out, then it became much easier the following year, and it became more a matter of just a process that was in place, and it became much easier. But so there was the initial worry that the administrative burden was going to be a huge amount for employers, but then they found it reduced over time as they got used to it.
You mentioned the pandemic; it has exacerbated many inequities. Has it done so for the pay gap?
Yes, very much so. I think we've seen that women have been forced out of the workplace, opted to take lower paid or part-time roles where possible so they can manage childcare when schools were closed, for example. And we found that women did that more than men. Some research by my colleagues here at King's College London was really looking at what kinds of employment women were forced out of or opted to leave, and what kind of work did work for women in the pandemic. And I think while we all know that COVID has shone a light on how like how many women have been forced out of work, etc. I also think it can be an opportunity to try and make progress on this. We've all seen flexible working and new models of work being pushed to the fore. So where it is possible to adjust workplaces to accommodate women, accommodate childcare, accommodate families, and accommodate those who have other caring responsibilities, then this is quite an important moment to do it. And that's why I'm hoping that we can learn lessons and we can make some kind of progress on the back of the global disaster that was, of course, COVID.
Minna Cooper-Coles, thanks very much. Minna is a research fellow and was the report author on this report from King's College London. 18 minutes past 9 on 9 to Noon. So let's reintroduce Mind the Gap co-founder Delwyn Stewart. Welcome again. Delwyn, could you just explain, Minna just alluded to something there. What are we measuring? Are we measuring men and women in the same job, or are we looking more at the same employer and sector? Because we often talk about the pay gap also being female-dominated industries, say, being lesser paid. Can you explain how we strike the gender pay gap measure?
Yeah, so men and women, or Pakeha and Pacifica, being paid the same rate for the same job is equal pay, and that has been enshrined in law since 1972. And the fact that we're having this discussion in the 50th year of the Act demonstrates that it has failed to deliver equal pay. We've got a gender pay gap stuck around 9%. And as Minna pointed out, and as you said in your intro, it is much more shameful at the points of intersection, both for ethnicity and gender, but also for ethnicity on its own. So a Pacifica man, for instance, only earns 81 cents for every dollar a Pakeha man earns. The gender pay gap is a way of comparing the average male earning to the average female earning within an organisation. So it gives you a very top level number, in the same way that the NZ Stats measures the gender pay gap at 9.1%. That's the average of all men versus all women.
Okay, so it's within an organisation, and this is where you can say if you have an all-male executive, say, and or all-male women middle management or a big skew, that's where you're going to get the pay gap, rather than two people doing the same job broadly and one being paid more than the other. But there are various ways you could strike that gap, I imagine.
Yes, and I mean, I alluded to this. One of the things that we don't have is a standard methodology, and that's something that we would like to see as part of the change we're calling for. So you'd need to look at things like what is actually measured in terms of compensation, and our advice is that it has to be total compensation. So it has to look at bonuses and KiwiSaver, the way that we reward in totality individuals. It needs a definition around who's actually measured. So it should include contracted staff and casual staff. As Minna said, you need accountability. So there need to be penalties for those who don't report, and they need to have some teeth. So what Mind the Gap is calling for is a mandated framework and a rhythm to transparency around pay gap reporting.
Who is reporting now? What is the picture here in New Zealand?
We launched as part of the campaign a pay gap registry on International Women's Day this year, and we had 51 organisations who are voluntarily reporting on their gender pay gap, a much smaller number on their ethnic pay gaps for Māori and Pacifica. And that really reflects the fact that that original Act in 1972 only considered gender. It didn't consider or require equal pay for ethnicity. So we've got 51 companies that need to be celebrated for actually doing this on a voluntary basis. Our focus is employers of more than 50 people. There are something like 6,000 organisations across New Zealand with more than 50 employees. So it's great to see 50.
It's about 1%, though, isn't it? It's not huge, is
it? Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity there.
What we'll talk a little bit more about the objectives at the moment of Mind the Gap. What is it that you're hoping to do?
Look, we're asking businesses to step up and report. We know a lot of businesses do measure but don't publicly report. Transparency is incredibly important to current consumers, investors, and staff in terms of the way that they look where they spend their time and money. So we've got a really strong campaign to talk to businesses to encourage them to do this voluntarily. But we're also calling on government to require businesses to report, to make it easy for them with a standard methodology, to report somewhere where businesses are already reporting, like NZ Stats, to make this, we believe, what is quite a small change legislatively, but can have a big benefit for the people of New Zealand.
We know you've got a social media campaign running just for those who aren't, so let's just get a little taste of it.
Hey.
Hey.
I was thinking about the pay gap thing.
Here we go.
I was thinking about how you said that when companies report pay gaps, it helps them to fix it.
Yeah.
So I started thinking, why don't companies just do it?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And then I figured it must just be like too difficult or something.
Yeah, makes sense. Businesses don't like things that are difficult.
No, they don't. But then I decided to look into which companies just report their pay gaps anyway. And
go on.
It's quite an impressive list.
It is.
Air New Zealand.
ANZ.
Fonterra.
Fletcher Building.
Sky City.
Bark.
The Warehouse.
TVNZ.
We could do this all day.
Well, at least until we read all the businesses on the Mind the Gap New Zealand Business Registry.
That's heaps.
That's a start.
Guess it's not that difficult after all, is it?
I guess not.
Anyway, I've got to go. I better get to work.
Are they paying you properly?
I guess we'll find out.
Some familiar voices there, Michelle Acourt and Courtney Dawson there. Does the public sector, Delwyn, have to report?
Yes, they do. They've got a couple of years under their belt now of reporting on their gender pay gap, and they've all got action plans to fix any gaps that they've got. And they're now also looking at ethnicity across the public sector. So one of the arguments for doing this is that we need to have an even playing field in terms of our labour market. We've got one set of practices in the public sector that is not required in the private sector, and we need to change that.
Thank you. Delwyn Stewart is with Mind the Gap, co-founder. Nearly 25 minutes past nine. We welcome back David McLean, former chief executive of Westpac, now at KiwiRail. Are you chair or CE? I've got both. Sorry,
I'm
David.
Chair, sorry.
You're
just chair.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll just make sure we've got that straight. Well, look, your mantra, I think, is what gets measured gets managed, and you can't fix a problem till you've seen it. So what did you find at Westpac when you assessed your gender pay gap?
Well, we were shocked because our gender pay gap at the time was over 30%. We hadn't realised that because we thought we had pretty much pay equity at every level, and we had over 50% women in leadership roles. But what that showed us was there's something about our organisation we hadn't realised, and that is that there was a heavy concentration of women in the lower paid roles, like in branches and contact centres, and a heavy concentration of men in the higher paid roles, like things like IT, business banking, and those sort of areas. So the makeup of our organisation was, you know, there was something about it that we hadn't actually realised before.
What were the factors in that disparity between the roles?
Historically, women, particularly women who didn't, say, have a tertiary qualification, would go generally into service roles in retail or maybe frontline banking, and men without those qualifications might have gone into heavy manual work. Whereas in, say, IT, it was heavily concentrated to men coming through university and going into IT careers. So from an early age, women and men were kind of steered, I think, almost perhaps inadvertently or, you know, partly consciously, into different roles. And that's something that had flowed through to our organisation.
What's happened, of course, is that IT has become so predominant in your industry and in most industries. And again, is there a heavy gender skew?
Absolutely. Very heavy. And that points to something, Catherine, that the gender pay gap measures something that you can't immediately fix. And so I'm sitting on the outside now and watching Westpac every year chip away at that and reduce it by a few percent every year, which is really positive. But you can't fix it overnight by waving a wand. You need to go out and say, OK, if we want more women coming into our IT department, how do we do that? Well, we need to go and maybe go to schools and get people from schools, girls from schools, to come in and see that IT is a valuable career. And, you know, we need more women, say, coming through to STEM subjects.
What was gender pay gap at WISPAC the last time you looked? How far have they gone?
It was in the mid to high 20s, so it's
still
come down
slow.
Quite a bit. Yeah.
But the other thing I would have thought is a lot of those branch positions have gone as well, and has that not had an impact on the skew? So a lot of the, you know, as we said, a lot of the branches are closed and have been replaced. Where do you, I know you're out of it now, but where do you see the issue now?
I think it's a similar thing. I mean, the branches might have been closed, but a lot of those people have been redeployed to helping people on the phones or on the, you know, on the computer. So the jobs haven't necessarily gone in the way that branches are gone, but it's the way that customers are wanting to be served now. But still, when I left, if we'd advertised a job in the contact centre or in the branch, the overwhelming majority of applicants were women. So
is there
a
deeper factor? Sorry, I'm wondering if there's a deeper factor with things like flexibility. Did you think at all about the old unconscious bias, which means we all like to hire people who are exactly like us, and that can be particularly prevalent in the management area? Did you find some other clues?
Yes, absolutely. And that is a very important point you make, Catherine, that unconscious bias or conscious bias, you know, we've got to admit that it does exist, plays a big factor. Workplaces that aren't safe or comfortable for women plays a factor. And another big factor is women in professional careers having to put their career on hold in a very important part, obviously, often in a time of their career which is really critical, to carry the burden of child raising, because society still puts far more weight on women to carry the heavy load of
the
child raising.
Businesses are still a little inflexible, perhaps, in enabling that to happen differently. And is that a big factor?
Yes, flexibility is very important. Parental leave, childcare, access to childcare, all those factors are very important. Parental leave policies in New Zealand, driven off the government policy, say that are all driven around the primary caregiver rather than an equal sharing of parental leave. So there's a number of factors. My key point here is that I think I'm really supportive of mandatory reporting on this, but I think, furthermore, I think employers should want to measure it, because if you measure it, you will find things about your organisation you don't know. And secondly, they should want to be transparent about it, to tell their staff and others about it, because it'll build trust amongst your own workforce and it'll improve your employment brand if people can see that you're doing something about this.
So what did happen when you reported a rather embarrassing figure, and it's probably no worse than many other businesses, but you did it and you reported it? What happened?
Well, we thought we were going to get beaten up, and we didn't, so that was quite good. People sort of gave us grudging recognition for having at least been honest about it. And I think the time will come soon where, in fact, the tables will turn and people will say to companies who aren't reporting, why not? What have you got to hide? So I think, you know, at the moment it's you can get more credit for reporting than not. And we got a lot of engagement from people telling us, you know, helping us with ideas about what we could do about it. Our staff were grateful for being told and wanting to engage. So it was generally a positive experience, even though it was a bad number.
You're at KiwiRail now as chair. That's an interesting industry to move into when we're talking about gender gaps in employment positions. What's the board doing, if anything, at KiwiRail?
Well, the KiwiRail is, as you say, very interesting. It's got a completely different set of challenges, and KiwiRail is measuring its gender pay gap as we speak and is going to be publishing it shortly and going on the register. But KiwiRail, interestingly, only has less than 20% of its workforce on women. So it's an incredibly male-dominated industry. And of the women in the workforce, most of those would be in what roles in the corporate centre rather than out on the, you know, on the tracks. So KiwiRail is, you know, a little microcosm of a sort of a previous, industry, heavy industry, where almost all of the workers doing, you know, sort of manual work were male, driving trains, you know, fixing the track and so on, building things. So that's a different set of challenges. But when we look at the gender pay gap, that'll tell us another insight into it and what we can do about it.
There's a lesson also in some ways, isn't there, in a very tight labour market at the moment where anyone is desperately looking to hire anyone, and whether it's unskilled or skilled. But if you've left behind the potential of half your workforce in certain areas...
Absolutely, you, yeah.
You might be coming up against it around about
Why
now.
Would you exclude yourself from a whole series of talent pools? Why wouldn't you make yourself as attractive to, as possible to as many talent pools as possible?
Can you answer that? What do you think's happening in the minds or the hearts of some people in positions of authority? Is some of it simply unconscious, or is some of it just too hard, don't want to know, got too many other things on my plate, really like having people just like me around me?
I think there's a lot of the latter. There's inertia and there's other things on the go. Everyone's a bit worn out. I don't want to do another thing. But I think a key factor is also perhaps nervousness about it. If I measure it, does that mean I've got to then do something about it and I don't know what to do? And that's the great thing with the Mind the Gap Registry. It's showing that there's 55, I think now, other large companies who are out there being transparent about it and working on it, and you can contact these companies, and most of them are very happy to share their experiences. It's not seen as a sort of a big competitive race. People want to try and fix this problem and are happy to share solutions. So, I think overcome that sort of nervousness about the issue and reach out for help.
Thank you. David McLean is now Kiwi Rail Chair, formerly Chief Executive of Westpac. Thanks also to Delwyn Stewart and Minna Cooper-Coles.